You're listening to Decolonize Social Work, a conversation about social work, oppression, and liberation. I'm your co-host, Drew.
And I'm your co-host, Ondine. All right. Welcome back, everyone.
Hello.
Is this the seventh episode or the eighth?
So many now, I've lost count.
Yeah, which in the podcast world isn't very many episodes.
I was at a conference recently, and I told somebody about our podcast. I was like, yeah, you know, we had been on a hiatus, and we just released our sixth episode. She's like, oh, I won't listen to it until there's 15.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, well, go ahead and subscribe to it. We'll get there. So.
Well, we're on our way.
Yeah.
Person from the conference.
You have that threshold. Yeah, I know.
So today's episode, we're going to talk about labor organizing and unions, especially in the context of social work practice. And we have a friend, a guest here today to help us with that conversation. So Matt is a historian and also a union member. Say some more about yourself.
Hi, everybody. I'm Matt. I'm a member of the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 227. I work for a big grocery chain as a meat cutter most of the time, but I'm actually out with the union talking to our members these days. We've got a governor's race here in our state this year, so getting out and talking to people and making some space for worker organizing is a big thing for me. And like Ondine said, I'm big into history, and so this is great. This is going to be great fun to talk about history and labor all together.
This Yay. Is going to be great. So thanks, Matt, for joining us today so you can kind of help us fill in the gaps around history, around labors and labor unionizing and labor organizing.
Do we want to also right now frame up how labor organizing and social work fits into the overall mission, I guess, of this podcast, which is like a decolonized or moving towards decolonized social work as well?
Yeah, take it away.
That was one of those things where you have an idea and then someone's like, that's great. Somebody should do that. Mm-hmm. And Ondine just gave me that look. So we've talked in our episodes about the conflict of social work when it gets kind of ensnared with the symptoms of colonialism, namely capitalism. And there's no place probably more immediately felt in social workers than the exploitation of our labor. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but how oftentimes our labor is undervalued actively because we're told that we didn't get into this job to make money. We got into it to help people. And while that can be true, we also, my landlord does not take goodwill as rent.
Sure doesn't.
The grocery store does not allow me to pay for my food because I'm a good person.
Right.
That would be awesome if we were at that place. And maybe that's where we will go, you know, in 1,000 years. But right now, you know, that is like the language that's used to exploit social workers. And there's also this tension, too, that like if we're supposed to be doing this because we feel good about ourselves, we're also taking on the burden of the quality of the work that sometimes we don't have a lot of control over because we're overworked.
That's right.
We're undersupported and we're undermined by our administrators. And so all of this is, again, a symptom of capitalism, which I still argue and kind of think that is also a symptom of colonialism. And so learning how we can dismantle the way we do social work practice that way and thinking of it differently is, again, kind of in the theme of what we're doing with this podcast, which is presenting a different way to do it in a direction that is probably not going to be where you typically find social work practiced.
So I don't remember having these conversations at all in school,
no.
Learning how to become a social worker. And actually, in all of my time doing social work, macro social work, and also direct client practice, we never talked about unionizing. We never talked about our labor beyond knowing that we were exploited because we're not getting paid a lot of money. And then talking about like the material conditions of the folks that we serve and how we felt like we didn't have any real control over that. And we will get into this a little bit more, but I think social workers often see themselves in a lot of ways as white collar professionals, which may or may not be true. We can dig into that a bit, but thus don't align with maybe labor organizing or unions. I think I grew up thinking that unions, the people who get into unions work at GE. They
trade
work on
job, right.
Trade job, like assembly lines. That there aren't unions for professional workers, which I know is not true, but that shaped my thinking.
Yeah.
Matt, I'd love to invite you into the conversation at this point. Tell us a little bit about what the heck a union is and maybe a little bit about how labor unions kind of came to be.
Okay. Yeah, totally. So before we begin, maybe it's necessary to talk a little bit about the labor theory of capital. So what I'm going to start with is by reading all of Marx's Capital, and then we'll get into that. No.
Because we have time for that.
No, I won't be doing that. But
the shortest 50-minute reading I've ever.
Right. So suffice it to say, I mean, and you all have talked about it, that like we trade our free time and our skills and our work for the thing we need to live, namely money, right? Yeah. So we can buy everything else. And what a union does is enables you to join with other people, typically people who do the same thing or similar things, so that together you can...
like bargain, right?
Yeah, bargain for better wages, better benefits, better working conditions, that sort of thing. And like I said, it can be people that are doing work that are similar to you. It can be people who are doing more or less exactly the same thing as you.
Because there are unions, right, that represent service workers, but they might work in a lot of different settings, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we'll get into that a little bit as I talk about the history, actually. And I'll just jump into that. So the first unions, at least in the United States, start actually around the 1790s or so. And
that is a lot earlier.
That's a lot earlier.
Than right. I would have thought.
And they start at the same time, more or less, as the first industrial revolution. And there's no coincidence there because you're bringing more and more people from sort of who were formerly rural workers into cities and that sort of thing to become, I mean, in a lot of cases they were recruited or sort of forced to go into these factories, weaving, shoemaking, skilled trades, that sort of, but sort of minor skilled trades that had formerly been practiced in the home were now being practiced in larger workplaces. And a lot of these people saw that they were being exploited and being taken away from what they had traditionally known and joined together to get better wages, mainly. And there's always been a lot of ebbs and flows of unions in the U.S. And before the Civil War, they didn't take hold very well. And it's only after the Civil War they really get going with the start of the second Industrial Revolution around the 1880s.
That's when I think of the Industrial Revolution, that's I think what I think. Right?
Yeah.
Like right before 1900.
Right. And that's where you really get mass manufacturing and the big factories with all the machines in it and that sort of thing.
So not really all that long ago.
No, really not at all. And that's where we start to get the American Federation of Labor, which was like a conglomeration of lots of smaller unions. And that's 1886 is when we get that. And the AFL is actually still with us, along with the Congress of Industrial Organizations from the 1930s. The CIO actually split from the AFL in the 1930s. And this is a thing we see a lot of in union organizing is people splitting
together.
With each other,
yeah,
and then coming back together when they start to see that it only benefits us when we're together, right?
It's probably the theme of the day, huh?
Yes. So, yeah, and so the AFL and the CIO came together in the 50s. And we see lots of good things out of unions throughout this history.
Yeah, what would you say are a couple that are... Yeah, what are a couple of things that really came from union organizing?
Like some wins.
Some wins.
I mean, the ones that are most recognizable and the ones that I think we take the most for granted now is the 8-hour day and the 40-hour work week, which comes out of that same organizing in the 1880s, and particularly out of the Haymarket Affair, which was a lot of protests and strikes and a riot and a bombing.
This was in Chicago, right?
Yeah. Everyone was agitating for shorter work hours because there was a time when people worked 12 to 15-hour days.
I think some social worker listeners are probably in touch with that feeling.
It's interesting to talk about the 40-hour work week and that I'm glad that was codified due to labor organizing and how we've kind of chipped away at that over time. And you know, when you have a salaried worker, like a social worker, you just have to work until the job is done. And it doesn't feel like there are any protections.
Yeah.
No protections. And then your salary is still calculated based on the traditional 40-hour work week. So the more you work, you're actually getting less pay per hour.
Yeah.
I've had that job. I'm sure a lot of us have had that job.
And I suspect a lot of gig workers understand that pretty intimately as well.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, and it took people going out on the street and actually fighting for this and joining with one another and three men dying to get that. Wow. So it's not nothing. And when we think about, like, racial justice, unions have been hand-in-hand with a lot of that. The I Have a Dream speech happened at the end of the March for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. Electrical workers, auto workers, hospital workers were notable in being a big part of that demonstration. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated while visiting striking sanitation workers in Memphis. Like, it's always been all of us together, right, that have made these things happen.
So there's a long and rich history of labor organizing in our country. I've been trying to do a little bit of reading in preparation for this episode about the ways that social work has interacted with that history. And I learned a couple things that I did not know. So Jane Addams is, like, they consider her like the mother of social work. And she founded settlement houses in Chicago. And so this was the beginning, I think, of sort of organized, well, it's not the beginning.
It's like the 1890s.
It's the 1890s. What I was going to say, it's the beginning of people coming together to address poverty and social ills, but it's not. Thank you, Matt, for all that context and that background. Mm-hmm. I think it's everybody's in a different place with their understanding of this history. And I don't remember learning much about labor organizing at any point in my education.
No,
did you guys learn about this in school? Like, any school?
Nope. I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, in high school, you know, they'd mention something like the Haymarket Affair or something like that. But, I mean, it would be, we certainly wouldn't spend a full day on it, right?
Right.
Like, it would just be, here's this thing that happened onto the whatever, World War One,
right,
or whatever the next thing is.
So I wanted to talk a little bit then about thinking about the history that Matt just laid out and how social work, the profession, lays over top of that. So I've been doing a little bit of reading in preparation for this conversation. So those of us that have gone to school for formal social work learned about Jane Addams and the settlement houses, and also Mary Richmond and the Charity Organization Society, and how these are considered kind of the... they're considered the founding of the profession, that social work as we know it today started with these movements. We know, of course, that that is a very white European way of thinking about the profession, but for the purpose of this conversation. So the settlement house movement was really about social change and policy initiatives, particularly for women and orphans, but there was a lot of organizing that came out of that work, and I didn't know this, but I guess Jane Addams was part of the development of the National Women's Trade Union League, which was kind of cool to learn, and that the organizing and conversations that were coming from the settlement house movement, that these folks were supporting striking workers, and the people in Hull House came together to form three unions. So the Women's Shirt Makers, the Dorcas Federal Labor Union, and the Chicago Women's Trade Union League all come from the settlement house work and Hull House's work in Chicago, which is, you know, this is like, this is the social work. These are really important. Go ahead.
I hope other people's social work education is better than mine, because that should not have been left out, especially since we cover that stuff already. That just should not be left out.
Yeah, well, I think what was really missing, as I was reading this and I was thinking about, okay, so we learned about Jane Addams, we learned about settlement houses, we learned about Hull House in particular, but I don't remember a conversation about there being community organizing coming out of that space, and that the settlement house movement, there was like a radical aspect to it. So, because continuing to learn about this, the article that I'm looking at right now, which we will link and share for you all, then talks about the charity organization movement, which Mary Richmond is sort of the person that we associate the most with that, a social worker. And that organization was not about advocacy, really, or about community organizing. So they took this perspective that people who are in poverty needed good sort of moral examples to follow. And they would do things called friendly visits to working poor. You'd go to their homes and essentially try to teach people how to live in a way that was more in line with, I guess, I don't know, not being poor? I'm not sure.
Right.
Probably a little cultural assimilation there, too.
You know? They really emphasized individual growth, right, and distinguished between worthy and unworthy poor. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the settlement house movement, it wasn't about individual growth. It was like collective bargaining and advocacy,
change.
More social change. So there was this tension, right, between these organizations. And what I was learning was that, you know, the settlement house movement, like the folks on that side of the fence were teaming up with labor at the time to really support the work because they were like, these conditions, these material conditions are bigger just than individual actions and we can all support each other. But that kind of died off after the First World War, or at least social workers' involvement in union organizing, early union organizing.
Hmm.
So I don't know, Matt, have you heard in any of the stuff you've read, if you've like seen anything about social workers in particular participating in labor?
Well, not social work per se, but like there was a sort of early recognition amongst labor organizers and workers that like the way that you work and your work conditions very much influence the way that you live mm-hmm. and the way you can treat the people around you. Right. And that's a big thing. And so that improving working conditions and that sort of thing drastically, you know, improved the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. And
that's why the 8-hour work week was, or the 8-hour work day was so important, was because it gave you more free time, mm-hmm. among other things, that you could do, you know, what you wanted with your time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's huge. That's huge for being able to treat trauma, say, for example,
right.
and that sort of thing.
So that kind of segues into the more specific aspect of social work with this, which, like, we're talking about your own well-being within this job and the conditions of work also are going to immediately affect the quality of services you are then carrying out with your clients, too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think unwell workers are going to be able to offer services that are going to make other people well.
Right.
You know? How does that kind of correlate, if you can even kind of make the correlation between like the output of like traditional trade labor services versus like, you know, kind of, I guess, social services and that output being affected? Does that make sense?
Hey, can I just take a moment? I just want to acknowledge. So we decided to record today at the public library. We have a really...
We're in the wild.
We're in the... Right. Normally we do this at our house and it's exciting. They have this sound recording booth and I hope that the audio is okay. But I there is somebody next to us who is living their best life recording their album.
The Voice.
So, yeah. They're going to be on The Voice. I don't know. But
you
may be able to hear some wailing in the background and that's why.
Crooning.
Some crooning. Yes, I didn't want to act like that wasn't happening.
If you're in your car, no, there is not a ghost behind you listening to this.
Support your public library.
So, sorry.
I don't know if you want to reframe that question up or...
I lost it.
That's okay. I think I knew where you were going, so maybe this will help.
Okay.
As we were learning and reading and thinking about this, one of the suggestions that came up from a social worker, was that social workers need unions. Social workers need to be unionized, but that historically, because the labor movement has been so focused on trade unions,
mm-hmm.
that their messaging has been about retirement, it's been about wages, it's been about benefits,
mm-hmm.
which are important to social workers. But social workers are also drawn to this work because you know, we believe we should do good work, and there's like
right.
an altruism there. And so the argument that this writer was making was that labor, if it's interested in attracting social workers and organizing them, has to broaden the messaging that the benefits of unionizing isn't just so that you get paid better and
mm-hmm.
you're treated better as a worker, but that it'll also impact the clients that we then serve
right.
and the quality of the services we offer. And if labor doesn't talk about it like that, social workers aren't going to pick up what they're putting down.
Right.
Is that kind of what you were trying to
Thank
say?
You.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I would love to hear your thoughts on that, Matt.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think that there is that emphasis. What I'll say is that my local bills itself as being very service oriented to our members. So it's not just so I mean, it is a lot of like nuts and bolts kind of stuff, like wages and that sort of thing. But it goes beyond that, too. There's continuing education that the union will help you with. There's interest-free loans, so you can get, you know, stuff done at home or on your car or whatever the case may be. And it's still, I think it's still very nuts and bolts, but there are those things that take a burden off of your mind, right? Mm-hmm. And give you the chance to work on yourself, to work on what you need to do so that you're not bringing, you know, all of your personal drama or whatever the case may be into your work with mm-hmm. you all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there's also probably an analogy to, like, teacher unions.
Yeah.
Or healthcare unions, mm-hmm. right? Or healthcare provider unions, because those are also some folks whose ability to actually be working in a safe condition is going to trickle down and have effects on, like, the quality of services they're doing. You know, here in Kentucky, we saw this past year kind of a resurgence of teacher organizing with our shithead governor talking about how teachers, you know, basically threatening their pensions and all this. And that got people pretty galvanized and came out and organizing.
And teachers have done a good job around the messaging there, right?
Yeah.
It's not just that they want their pensions protected, because that's important enough, but that they talk about how this matters because then kids are impacted
right. Well.
Like the impact on the kids is that they receive, you know, better education because their teachers are more invested in the work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Drew, you and I, in preparation, too, for this conversation, we're kind of chatting about that and about how we wondered if one negative consequence or potential hijacking of the message that social workers should unionize is that people will say, if social workers go on strike, then people suffer, that there'll be more harm done. If we don't show up to work, our clients and our patients will suffer. And is that not selfish? Is that really the right way to go about trying to enact change?
The teachers in our state got accused of that, too,
right.
When they went on strike, when they called out, when they were doing sick outs. And I think, again, we were having a conversation before this podcast. One of the things we talked about was, like, it's not whether or not the social workers or, you know, the teachers, but in this case, the social workers, not whether or not they're there is not going to affect whether or not bad services or harm is being caused. If anything, they are minimizing the harm at their own sacrifice and at their exploitation. So really, the harm's already going to be there. It's just mitigated by their altruism. The harm isn't going to stop just because, or harm isn't going to subside if they suddenly strike. You know, it just kind of pulls the mask off of it. Like, actually, it's really this bad.
Yeah. Right. I was thinking about this in the context of places I've worked where I've done, like, direct casework with clients. And I was just trying to imagine, like, what would happen if I went on strike, right? And the folks like me went on strike. And that it's quite possible people would say that we were selfish and that we weren't prioritizing our clients. And a lot of the folks that we work with have been stripped of power because of institutional racism and oppression and because of the capitalist machine. And if we don't strike as social workers, then what disrupts that machine, right?
Yeah.
I think that's to me is worth it. And what I'm hearing you say, Drew, is that harm is already being done because
right.
the system is so broken that people aren't receiving the kind of services and support they need. So what do we stand to lose?
Yeah.
And I think some people will still feel the ethical, moral dilemma of, like, what sort of neutered bad services I am able to provide is still better than nothing, and those people can't go without it. Like, I work in housing, so, like, it's very time-sensitive sometimes. Like, I might, in a 7-day period, be all that stands between somebody getting an eviction ordered against them or not. And there is a risk there that if I strike, that person might not get somebody who's like me to be able to stand in between that, and they might actually get evicted.
It's also a lot of pressure on you that, like,
you
can never stand up for what's right in terms of your labor.
It is. And it's also, I think, going back to what you said, indicative of the fact that, like, that harm is going to happen, because let's look at it a different way. I might be able to help one person, but there are 10 other people that I just don't get to help
mm-hmm.
who still are going to get evicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's just like kind of trying to, I don't know, I don't have a good disaster analogy for it right now, but, like, it is like, I think we have to kind of sit in that ethical dilemma a little bit and realize, like, you're not the catcher in the rye. You're not going to save everything. It can't just be on you. Like you said, it can't be pressure. And sometimes maybe we just have to pull the veil off of it and just expose it. Like, this is actually how the system works. This is what it's doing. And it's kind of disingenuous to think that I'm the only person that's going to stop it. We talked about that with white supremacy culture, too, of that mm-hmm. concept of, like, I am the only one that can do this. I'm the only one that can save something. I am the only one that is going to save people from this thing. And, like, actually, that is, you know, how we are kept in place by thinking, by being taught that, like, well, the pressure is all on us. And if you shrug off this responsibility, it's all your fault. If this person gets evicted, yeah. it's not the system's fault. It's not the social injustice fault. It's your fault. You're the responsible party for this being carried out. And that's fucked up.
Yeah, yeah. And I have felt that as a social worker in jobs before.
Yeah,
that I failed.
Yeah. I feel like I've failed people.
Yeah. Stemming from what you were just saying, Drew, I think this is a good example. So in preparing again for this conversation, I was doing a little research and I stumbled upon a really cool article written in The Socialist Worker by a person named Erica West, who is a social worker in Oakland. And it is about, well, this is a little dated now. This article came out in December of 2018, but it was about social workers and mental health professionals striking in California as part of the National Union of Healthcare Workers, because Kaiser Permanente, which is a huge, like, medical organization, was failing its patients and clients. I think they got sued and ended up owing a lot of money because after the Affordable Care Act passed, they didn't honor the, like, mental health care parity piece. Yeah, of course, right? Actually, yeah, they paid a $4 million fine for that. So,
good Lord.
I know, right? So mental health care clinicians and social workers were striking because of this. And it really was about the poor care that patients and clients were receiving. So in this article, Erica talks about examples of mental health care workers asking Kaiser to fund behavioral health groups for people with suicidal ideation, and they wouldn't pay for it. They just wouldn't do it. There was another example of a woman who was trying to get her husband access to mental health care and really needed individualized therapy. And Kaiser wouldn't pay for it, wanted this person to participate in group therapy or, you know, take medication. And those interventions weren't working for him, but they wouldn't pay for it. And so the strike was a lot about that. And there could have been some stuff wrapped up in there, too, about their wages and their working hours and whatever. But mm-hmm. I was taken with how this was primarily about the services then and the way that they fail the patients.
Right.
And maybe less so about the actual material working conditions of the social workers, although those things go hand in hand.
Right.
Yeah, so
There's a sentence in here, if I can share it.
Yeah, please do.
Erica West said, just as teachers say our working conditions are our students' learning conditions, social workers can say our working conditions are our clients' healing conditions. And I think that kind of sums up the... This is a web that is all connected.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just address one issue over another. You can't just say, like, oh, we're going to, you know, throw all this money into opiate addiction.
Right.
But then just still overwork and just squeeze all the blood you can out of the workers. Like, right. It's not going to help anybody.
So I don't, you know, folks listening may be wondering, well, then how do I start a union? How do I join a union? And I was wondering, Matt, if you could kind of share a little bit about how that happens.
Oh, totally. So there are probably locals and union headquarters in your town, in your city. Your best bet is usually to tap into one of those. There are, so like I said before, there are unions that sort of are very specific about a particular trade or a particular profession, right? But there are also those that are much, much wider. So I think the key is to find sort of what's in your area and see if they're running an organizing campaign or if they have an organizer that can come to you. And the reason I say you should sort of find what's in town to begin with is because you don't really want to reinvent the wheel on organizing yourself or your friends. But also there's going to be, you know, someone there with some expertise in doing this. And also it means if there's somebody in town, it means that you'll have a representative for your workspace
mm-hmm.
right away as soon as you're organized. And that's someone who can back you up on things like discipline, on things like working conditions, who will know your contract that you sign with your employer inside and out, so that you don't have to know every detail of that yourself. And they can then go to the larger organization as needed about any conditions that you face, right?
So if I'm a social worker and let's say I work for... I don't know. I work for a nonprofit organization that provides services to youth. And I work there with five or six other social workers. Mm-hmm. Can I form a union even though there's just five or six of us?
Yes, absolutely. So the way it typically works is you'll get your people together. You'll go to an organizer and you'll talk through, sort of what you want your contract to look like and that sort of thing. And then you'll present those demands to the employer. Now, because of the way organizing works in the United States, the employer can start to ask for exceptions to the National Labor Relations Board. And there's a whole history behind that. And it sort of makes union organizing a little harder than it actually has to be for pretty obvious reasons, I think. Now they can start, like I said, they can start to ask for exceptions and so can exclude people on this grounds or these grounds or whatever. But usually you can just go do that and hopefully they'll accept, all five or six of you. Mm-hmm. Or if the rest of your workplace feels strongly enough about it, you can actually organize the entire workplace, even though you all do different things.
That's a really interesting thing to think about because a lot of social workers work in settings that are interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So, for example, schools will employ one or two, maybe if they have a big budget, three social workers who are working within a lot of teachers, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe all of those folks can unionize in the same union.
Yeah, that's absolutely possible. And think of it in the same way that, and this is my experience, is I work at a grocery, and so I'm a meat cutter. There's a guy at the back door that receives all the shipments. There are produce people. There are baggers and cashiers. We all do very different things from one another, and there's not a whole ton of crossover between us, but we're all part of the same union because we all work in the same space. Mm-hmm. And there sort of was a time when we might all have been different unions. There was a specific meat cutters union one time, and the back door guy might have been a Teamster, and then blah, blah, blah. And all of that sort of got subsumed there are a lot of reasons for that. But, yeah, you can absolutely be all different things working for each other's benefit in one union.
Mm. Matt, if I am a social worker, are there any risks I should anticipate if I'm going to start talking about unions at my place where I work?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm glad you asked that question.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. So, depending on your employer, right? I mean, I think you can possibly expect some retaliation. I mean, technically it's illegal, but if you work in like a at-will state, like our state is, they can fire you for trying to organize a union and just say they're firing you because you were consistently late.
Just for a point of clarification, since we have listeners all over the place, working at will, these are really awful laws that get passed in states that they're called right to work, which is a really confusing way of saying we can fire you for any reason.
Confusing. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about at will states, that's what we mean.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, there could be some backlash. There could be, they could try to, an employer can try to sort of split you all up and start playing favorites and do that sort of thing. That thing happens. There's some stuff there that you should be aware of.
Do you have any guidance or suggestions from your own experience about what could be done to curtail or protect against some of those risks or retaliations?
Yeah, I would say make sure you document stuff as much as possible. If you're able to record conversations or stuff, maybe do that. Just make sure that you're doing everything by the book and that you're not giving reasons. And I don't mean to put all of the pressure on the employee, on the worker, but that that's sort of what the employer is going to do, right? So make sure you have all of your bases covered. Yeah. And
this is part of the role of the union organizer is to kind of help the employees figure out what those bases are.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And what
absolutely.
Steps to take. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that if you're unionizing at work, you want to make sure you know the employees that are on board and have numbers and commitments before the management finds out.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it sounds like in the initial stages, the more discreet you are, the better, perhaps.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And, if you're going to do this, make sure you have a good working relationship with your coworkers. Mm-hmm. A union is, if nothing else, it's a series of relationships. So make sure you have good relationships and build those relationships.
We're supposed to be good at that in our job, right? That's like one of the things we're supposed to do.
It's that social part.
Yeah.
It's the social aspect of our work. Yeah, you would think so. It also, this is a topic for a different episode, but it also leads me to wonder to myself if a different work model altogether is a better option, such as a cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically would be like, I don't know, it sounds to me basically a union, except there's no boss anymore. It's just a union. It's a cooperative of people who kind of collectively, agree on salaries and benefits and terms of work and whose work is, who's going to do what and all that.
Yeah.
Which I said, I don't want to get into the
weeds
about
should,
that because that's
I
a
think
different.
I think there's space in there for another episode.
Maybe there is one down the pipes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice. But, I think that's helpful too because I think that's, at least in my cursory understanding of it, any thought about unionizing, I always feel like it's like there's a lot of risk there. Like, what's to stop them from just firing me and hiring some scabs to replace me just because that's the easiest way to curtail any easiest way to prevent any progression of unionizing? And I think that could be a scary risk, too, because not all of us can just risk getting fired.
Most of us can.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of us can't. I certainly don't have just a job just holding a space open for me behind me over here. Be like, in case you lose your other job, just come work here. No gap in income or anything like that. So I think that's another fear that comes up a lot for folks to think about, like, what if the worst case scenario happens? What then?
And, just before you get started with it, make sure you weigh the risks and the benefits and just be aware of those risks. Absolutely.
I was reading as well that social work, in the effort to professionalize social work, has really the practice has distanced itself from community organizing and activist stuff. Right, the foundations of Jane Addams's work. That's just not where we are these days. And so I think it's important to revitalize this conversation about who we are and who we want to be. Or some people will look at it going back to the root, right, of being in collaboration with labor and really embracing those values and ideals as social workers.
I also just want to kind of speak directly to the social workers with a little bit who have had a little bit more access to greater professionalization or greater education, specifically UMSWs like myself out there. There's been some research that's shown that a higher percentage of people with bachelors of social works or even paraprofessionals who don't even have a social work degree are more likely to favor unionization than MSWs. And it's thought that part of that is because the caseworkers, the paraprofessionals, the BSWs, the bachelors of social works are the ones doing kind of the harder street-level
work,
the trench work, the social change work, and the MSWs are either moving up to admin jobs, which are boss-level jobs, or, private kind of clinical jobs. And I just want to say that, that hierarchy is bullshit, and we have to get out of that because this social work stuff doesn't work if we're just replicating those hierarchies that just tear apart our society already. And that's kind of coming back to the theme of decolonization. It's like, that's a colonizer tactic. That's a separation tactic.
Right. That's
and
right.
We have to get out of that and focusing more on the collective good, not just on the inside internal operations of our social work, but also what that's going to do to our clients. Because if I'm just an MSW who just doesn't, maybe I feel like I'm underpaid and that's why it's easy for me to stomach the fact that my caseworkers make $20,000 a year, And then they want to unionize, and I feel like, well, I don't make a lot of money either, so stop your whining. Like, that's not the answer. That's not the answer.
And I want to add that not everybody with a master's level social work, MSW, is in an admin job. MSWs also do trench work, are underpaid. But I do hear this distinction. It seems like, you know, there's like that, like, more money, more problems, or more education. It's people forgetting, like, where they came from, right?
In a bit, yeah.
Or just, you know, you climb the ladder a little bit, and you just, you know, you pull up the ladder behind you, right? And that's not what we need to be doing.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, your fellow worker is never your enemy. You gain so much more by working together than you do by working against each other. And in a lot of cases, that's exactly what the employer wants you to do, is to sort of fight each other so that you never stand to gain anything.
Yeah.
And again, we talked about that in the last episode, how, like, that disconnect between people, whether it's separation of families, you know, separating families because people are going to prison, or even internally separating, you know, collaborative unionized work, that's all colonizer bullshit that we have to name, we have to recognize, that we, you know, we may intentionally or unintentionally be doing, but we have to name it so that we can recognize it and work over it to kind of get back to this core idea that, like, this is social, this is transformative change, and that this is not the way that we just have to keep doing this.
Definitely. And I also, in this article I was reading, they cited some studies around social worker attitudes and organizing. And I think, Drew, this just backs up what you were saying about the bachelor's level social workers and paraprofessionals. So in this study of 360 social work union members, they were kind of learning a little bit about why those folks had joined the union and what they perceived to get out of it. And their findings also showed that social workers of color were found to be more supportive of unions than white social workers, where we've talked about this a lot, and, like, sort of the racialized divisions of labor. And, you know, they posit that part of that is that people who are racially or ethnically, like, you know, oppressed in our country have found that, like, being a part of a union can protect them from workplace discrimination in a way that, you know, white social workers would never even think about and not think that affects them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So white people.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's worth, we need to think about that too.
Yeah. Well, imagine too, and I'm just throwing this out here, like, say a neighborhood is able to organize itself. They have, like, tenants unions, so they're not paying too much for their housing. You know, they're able to get proper repairs to their housing and that sort of thing, and they have, you know, they've bargained a really good relationship with their landlords and that sort of thing, and they now have the wherewithal to start putting together things like the cooperatives that you were talking about, so childcare cooperatives,
grocery co-ops.
Yeah, grocery cooperatives.
Walking dogs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Services up to and including healthcare and that sort of thing. I think that would change, or I would have to think that would fundamentally change the nature of social work, where a social worker would become more like what I consider our union area reps to be, where, well, looks like you all mostly have this under control, and, you know, we're not here to change anything, but, you know, if you need help, you know, what resources can I give you? Mm-hmm. Is there, you know, extra education do you need? Do you need, you know, money to help build a center? You know, where can we start doing these things that really, really help you all?
What you're saying, Matt, gets me thinking about social workers becoming labor organizers.
Yeah, in some ways.
Yeah, and we've talked about in social work in our podcast before that community organizing is social work. People who do community organizing are social workers, even if they don't see themselves that way. And it just occurred to me, we should be encouraging social workers to become union organizers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a really good role for us.
Yeah. Well, that'd be cool if schools had, like, you know, they have the micro tract and the macro tract. There was, like, a labor tract that just kind of specialized social workers in how to work out these relationships and become kind of a little bit more focused and trained on being labor organizers. Maybe you do go to, like, your community mental health clinic and do it. Maybe you do it at, like, your meat cutters, you know, association, you know, because those are, like, I've been trying to rethink of that those skills, like they're often called like soft skills, but like those are really hard skills to learn too. I want to kind of reframe that as like those are hard skills too. Mm-hmm. Just because they're not tangible skills doesn't mean they're not hard, that they're not important. So I don't know.
And I think macro, I mean, that's really what macro social work should be.
Yeah.
And I think in schools, macro social work, every school handles that differently. And it tends to be broadly about sort of poverty and policy making and advocacy. But mm-hmm. there could be more of a focus under that on like, what are the actual jobs we would do, right? If we become macro social workers, it'd be like labor organizer, you know, politician, mm-hmm. something else.
Imagine that, teaching social workers to take better care of social workers.
I would like to add, so I pulled kind of a briefer fact sheet from the AFL-CIO on social workers and unions, and a couple things that kind of stood out to me that I think reinforced this conversation we're having. So I learned that there were social workers in Baltimore who joined the American Federation of Teachers Union and were able to negotiate opportunities to discuss their workload and their caseloads to have those changed. I also learned here that in 2015, social workers represented by unions made roughly 30% more than their non-union counterparts. Yeah.
There you go. Yep.
So for a profession that's already like super, super underpaid, I think that has to resonate, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's typically true across the board as well in states that are have sort of normal union relations versus right-to-work states where... I think I'm remembering this correctly, that typically right-to-work states, the average household income is like $3,800 less or something like that.
Wow.
There's always that sort of discrepancy. And there's more workplace accidents in right-to-work states and that sort of thing, too.
I'm glad you said that, because another thing that I read was that, you know, the benefits of unions for social workers are to address, you know, you can address things like wages, but also mm-hmm. workplace safety.
Yeah.
And there's been a ton of legislation, state legislation and federal legislation proposed to protect social workers from like workplace danger.
Yeah.
You know, especially social workers go out into communities and sometimes don't know what they're walking into.
Sometimes go into people's homes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's been, you know, unfortunately some people have died, right, because of danger and violence. And at any rate, that being a part of a union allows you the space to negotiate those circumstances and where you would work and how you would do your work and how you'd mm-hmm. be protected. And
mm-hmm. and it gives you a great big organization at your back that says that they can hold your employer accountable if mm-hmm. there are any problems about like OSHA violations or any of those sort of safety mm-hmm. Concerns.
I know we're kind of going to need to wrap up here shortly, but I want to jump back to Erica West's article from the Socialist Worker about the strike at Kaiser Permanente, because I think they say a couple of things that are just, as I was making my notes, I just like made all kinds of X's and exclamation points, and because I thought they had so much good stuff to say. So here's one that really resonated with me. So, quote, like teachers, social workers are underpaid despite working incredibly hard and facing the worst consequences of capitalism. Some have called social workers the janitors of capitalism. When capitalism leads to alienation, unemployment, substance use, and violence, it is social workers who often come in to support the victims through the consequences. I was like, oh my God, that's a read right there. Like this is what we talk about all the time. I don't know if y'all have any reactions to that, but it really resonated with me.
No, that's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something else that stood out, this really stood out. So they say social workers and mental health professionals are often exploring the best and newest ways to support our clients. So new therapeutic modalities, new ways to practice trauma-informed care, and so on. When one of the best ways for us to support our clients and something our field has yet to explore completely is to fully utilize our power as workers. So again, you know, gosh, I have a lot to say about trauma-informed care and the buzzword that has become. That's probably for another episode. But we need to start thinking about our own power, right, and organizing ourselves as a way to mitigate the social conditions that capitalism creates.
Right.
Yep.
Not only our own power, but our power together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And lastly, they say there's no therapeutic model that will make a huge caseload tenable. There is no workshop that can teach us the best way to eradicate decades of trauma and abuse in one session. And I was like, yep, all of that.
That's a fine place to conclude, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Put the social back in social work. Unionize.
Unionize.
That's your T-shirt right there.
Awesome.
So we will we'll drop some links in our social media and on our website. Some of the papers and articles we read. If anyone's interested in exploring forming a union in their workplace, we'll drop some links and some resources for you so that you can explore that. I think I'm urging you to unionize.
Yeah.
And hey, if you are a social worker in a union, get in touch with us.
We would love to hear your experience.
We would love to maybe talk to you on the air as a follow-up, because this certainly shouldn't be the last time. This will not be the last time we talk about labor rights and unions on this podcast.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Matt?
Well, thank you all for having me on, among other things. It was really, really fun. Yeah, and there's lots of great resources out there. I'll contribute a couple things that they can put up for you all about what is a union and some of those basic introductory things if you want to know more.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Man. Thank you all.
I also just want to thank our crooner, a resident crooner next to us, for giving us a little background. background
jam. Ambiance.
Ambiance.
Yeah.
A little haunted ambiance for your October spirits.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I think that should do it for us, huh?
That should do it.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
Awesome. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Decolonize Social Work, a podcast about social work, oppression, and liberation. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud at Decolonize SW, and on Instagram at Decolonize Social Work.